to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Hollywood 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Dial C for Khan by Vanessa Grigoriadis and Josh Dean, with photos by Paul Hansen. We tried to contact Sutopo and failed, but we did find the soap opera actor who agreed to talk to us as long as we didn't report her name. Sutopo was now her ex-husband, and, she said, he was a fraud. Gobind, the nickname of Tal Rahmani, was his protege. So we started to realize that Foodfluencer was probably just one of Tal Rahmani's many guises. She said they'd met at Indonesia's Sipening prison, where Sutopo took the younger man under his wing, offering him protection. A prison official told us that the two men would meet often and that Sutopo was, in his estimation, a naughty man. This actor told us that Tal Rahmani, as far as she knew, was now on the up and up. Living in London, she said, working for HBO, he was also a food blogger, and she heard from him all the time, almost every day, but always by DM, from one of his many social media accounts. She also didn't have a phone number or email for him. They talked often, yes, but he was the instigator, and for whatever reason, this caginess on his part never struck her as odd, until we told her about the scam. After the Hollywood Reporter first reported the Khan Queen story in 2018, theories about the scammer's identity abounded. Many assumed that the Khan Queen was a bitter ex-assistant with enough contacts and a working knowledge of how Hollywood conducts itself to pull off such a con. If the allegations about Tal Rahmani are true, it was the opposite of such an inside job. He might as well have been from another planet, though he may have lived in Los Angeles briefly and may have a background that drew him close to film. According to Jakarta-based journalist Devanti Farids, Tal Rahmani's father was a 1980s film producer, Lal C. Tal Rahmani, who wrote rom-com and dramatic scripts and worked out of a production house across the street from the family home. His mother was his protector, and after she died, he was apparently at loose ends. When his father died, he had fights with his sister over the family's inheritance. A local chef said that he heard Tal Rahmani was racking up big phone bills, which angered his sister. A source said Tal Rahmani had a falling out with his siblings over property disputes. One sister did not respond to attempts for comment, and the other could not be located. A prison official in Jakarta told us that Tal Rahmani's family pressed the charges that got him imprisoned in Jakarta in the late 2000s, and several sources in London said that he talked often about how he'd been cast out of the family. One photographer, who was hired to take portraits of him when he was using the alias Gavin Ambani, in the London restaurant world he posed as the relative of one of India's richest men, and then never repaid, said, this Instagram food thing was supposed to be a way for him to gain acceptance from his family. Tal Rahmani attended the elite Gandhi Memorial Intercontinental School in Jakarta, where instruction is in English, before moving to the United States for college. According to sources, he started his education at L.A. City College, and was active on the competitive speech team before transferring to Bradley University in Peoria, Illinois, in 2000. That year, he reached the quarterfinals of the National Forensic Association competition in persuasive speaking, while calling himself Harvey, an alias he would come back to often in later life. He left Bradley, enrolled at Cal State University, Long Beach, and, per a source, continued to compete in speech until he was caught plagiarizing and was disqualified from a tournament. After the event, according to John Parsi, another debater, he made a series of calls to various individuals about how upsetting this experience was. He pretended to be Kate Blanchett calling on his behalf. This was a low-level prank, but Tal Rahmani, while imprisoned in Sipening in Indonesia, did something he might have imagined as merely naughty, but had serious implications. He called in a bomb threat to the U.S. Embassy in Jakarta from a mobile phone he had hidden in his cell. To make this threat, Tal Rahmani put on the voice of an American, then an Iranian, and then a Russian, in different phone calls. He said, "There's a bomb, and it's going to explode in 72 hours. He had also allegedly threatened to blow up the Pentagon while living in the U.S. "My fun is to vent my frustration on my family," he told a local newspaper. The reporter wrote, "Gobind was nonchalant about making the bomb scare. He even laughed when retelling the incident that caused his prison sentence to be extended. Covering his face with his hands, he chuckled and said it was only a joke." When cell phones throughout the prison were confiscated because of the bomb threat, a source said prisoners beat Tal Rahmani severely. A former prison employee, Kater Fatiani, said that Gobind also often talked about how he could impersonate women's voices. Still, some of the chaos Tal Rahmani sowed was of the lighter sort. After prison, he held a premiere bash for the Second Sex and the City movie in Jakarta, but according to a contractor who worked for the event, the coordinators were never paid. According to sources, in 2011, he claimed to be organizing a Miss Teen Indonesia pageant. He approached Tyra Banks' management, according to one of the sources, claiming that Katy Perry was also on the bill, and asked if Banks wouldn't mind wearing an outfit from one of Indonesia's batik designers. And he even booked Enrique Iglesias to play the show. Iglesias reportedly flew to Jakarta, but upon landing, realized it was a scam. His team posted about what had happened on his Facebook, writing, "Sorry to inform you, but the Miss Teen Indonesia 2011 event in Jakarta is a big fraud, which was set up by crooks that have unfortunately done this before." The post then identified one of the crooks as Harvey Tahil, a combination of two aliases Tal Rahmani had been known to use. The Hollywood con queen scam may seem at first like some kind of madcap Tootsie misadventure, a mostly powerless man pretending to be a powerful woman. But the con queen seems to have done little that was not self-interested. Establishing relationships with a Mark's friends and family could have been a way for the con queen to establish a deeper trust. This was certainly the case for Mondanaro. According to Mondanaro, his funds for the Jakarta expedition were largely coming from his family, and the con queen spent hours on the phone with his mother and later Mondanaro's sister, who worked at Goldman Sachs. Mondanaro says that the con queen always made his family feel that Mondanaro was just one step away from getting his script made into a major blockbuster and turning into a superstar screenwriter. She exerted control by giving the impression that the project could be dropped any time to my family so that my family would keep me under their thumb because they were paying for it, says Mondanaro. "We didn't think that this was a con. We thought it was a manipulative business tactic to keep the talent in check." And among the most disturbing parts of the con queen's alleged scam was the way she is said to have lured men into phone sex. According to victims, she targeted actors whom she could pretend to audition. we spoke with an actor who acted out a sex scene in an elevator with a fake Deb Snyder, the wife and producing partner of Justice League director Zack Snyder. This actor says he was so confused by the experience that he called his father to ask what he should do. Should he continue to participate in sex talk with a woman he believed could change his life by delivering him a role in a blockbuster film? When he found out that he had been conned, he was so disturbed that he moved away from the industry and now lives in Hawaii. This part of the alleged scam was a reversal of Me Too. Instead of a powerless woman being harassed by a male executive with a casting couch, a female executive was taking advantage of handsome, low-level Hollywood players. The con queen tended to look not for only actors, but stuntmen and fitness trainers. We heard one shocking tape recording that John Frey, a trainer in Portland, Oregon, took of the con queen playing Deb Snyder. The fake Deb seems like she's grooming Frey for some sort of personal role in her life. She says that she's requested a technical advisor to sort of safeguard the assets, which is myself, and obviously the project. She explains that she's calling because she has a new film in the works, and there are going to be a lot of different scenarios happening with our production company, the Stone Quarry. We're financing the bulk of it, as opposed to what we did with Cruel and Unusual films, you know, which was blessed by the gods of Warner Brothers. This one has far more of an independent, not an independent budget, but an independent in the sense that it's out of our pocket, my pocket. It's chilling listening to the fake Deb try to get Frey to believe her. Sometimes she is conspiratorial. All my life now, been in the shadow of Zack and behind the scenes, she says, adding that she needs a good trainer because I will be now front and center. And then she's expansive, adding, what I'm not comfortable sometimes is in my own skin, and then there is the spiritual advisor who has prepped you, not the personal trainer, the friend that looks at you and watches you and protects your integrity and your appeal to the craft. But at the end of the conversation, she lowers her voice a bit and becomes serious. She talks about the earlier call the two of them had, and how much she wanted to talk to him again after discerning his hunger for success. I could hear how humble and excited you were to get a call from us. Really, you could feel that, and that's exactly what I wanted to hear. In his life, as a London food influencer, Tal Rahmani was often a man with a plan, telling people that he had great things in store for them if they did what he wanted. He even coaxed famous Bahraini chef Roya Saleh into participating in what, according to Saleh's Instagram post, was a Netflix project about restaurants. Saleh later posted a faux trailer shot in her restaurant on her Instagram feed. According to sources, he often introduced himself as an HBO executive, or more often as a Netflix employee, as he did when he registered for the 2017 Lululemon Sweat Life Festival. He made himself known to chefs around town at the finest restaurants, including Itamar Shrulevich, co-owner with his wife of the Honey & Company food empire. Shrulevich, interestingly, says Tal Rahmani came in often and made himself known as an influencer, but didn't ask for meals for free. He was a bon vivant, Instagramming photos of enjoyable meals. In one post, he showed off his own spaghetti with lemon, which he called a simple interpretation of a dish from one of his favorite restaurants, Ruthie Rogers's River Cafe. This dinner, he wrote, took him back to pre-COVID times, when he would sit in the restaurant, looking at the gorgeous river views of Hammersmith as I drifted away with friends and family, talking about a glorifying future with daring conquest and endless laughter. Tal Rahmani also created bonds in the restaurant world by telling others that he was bullied for being perceived as gay in Indonesia. He even claimed in the September video chat that he had been sent to conversion therapy at a mental institution because of it. To be a soldier and a warrior doesn't mean you have to fight a war. You didn't have to go to battle and take out your firearms and shoot some weapons and things like that, he said in the September video chat. I went through a war of my own, a struggle of my own as a child, because maybe I was a little bit more expressive than other boys. Maybe I enjoyed watching films other boys wouldn't watch. Maybe I didn't like soccer so much, and I appreciated literature over soccer, he added. People would laugh at me and call me bunchy and faggot. Toward the end of last year, as he perhaps figured out that he was going to be identified by name in our podcast, Tal Rahmani may have decided that impersonating women was too attention-grabbing and allegedly started impersonating a man, director Doug Liman. On the phone with actors and a stuntman, the fake Liman explained he was shooting Lockdown, his upcoming HBO Max film about a couple who boost jewelry during the pandemic lockdown. He said in a gossipy tone that he had smuggled Anne Hathaway, the star, into the country, ostensibly because Americans weren't supposed to travel to the UK during that time. Now he was interested in securing actors and others for the film he was soon to make with Tom Cruise and Elon Musk, the untitled SpaceX project to be shot in outer space. One of the actors asked the fake Liman to join a video call just to verify that he really was who he said he was, and he became furious. You want me to verify who I am? He sneered. If your dick is still there in a couple of days, I won't kill you, but I want you mutilated. There is something other than a hard childhood here, something more than feeling like an outcast, something about needing to cut other people down to size and threaten them, something about envying women, particularly powerful ones, and feeling unimportant, something deep and misogynistic. The con queen often told the people he was allegedly conning that he wanted them to feel safe, and that he wanted them to make him feel safe, too. This made some sense when the fake Amy Pascal, or whichever woman he was impersonating at the moment, was talking to ex-military men looking for jobs as Hollywood bodyguards and security consultants. But it was still creepy, and it was something that he allegedly said to other victims, too, who had no background in security. He might have wanted coziness, love, warmth in his life, but only if he could remain in total control. Hearing the voice, and then seeing his face, and learning it as a food blogger, put me in a weird place mentally, one of the victims wrote us via email after the Manchester arrest. All this time, he was just a wannabe influencer, trying to prove to the world that he was worth a shit by pretending to be someone he isn't, and funding his fake lifestyle with dirty money. Thank you. Promising Young Women by Joy Press. Women directors in the 1970s set the scene for decades of film and television breakthroughs. Now they're finally getting their due. Opening photos, girls. A still from Joyce at 34. Claudia Wheel filming Joyce Chopra in a phone booth on the set of Joyce at 34. And The Way They Were, a still from Claudia Wheel's 1978 film, Girlfriends. Wheel and Melanie Mayron in 1978. Wheel, Mayron, and Christopher Guest on the set of Girlfriends. A woman lies in bed, barely visible in the smudgy darkness. A clicking sound awakens her. "What are you doing? It's still dark in here," she mumbles, annoyed. Her roommate becomes dimly visible, hovering over her with her camera. "No, it's not," she says. "This light is fantastic." The first time I watched Claudia Wheel's 1978 feature film Girlfriends, a decade or so ago, I felt an immediate spark of connection with its portrait of the artist as an anxious young woman. Susan, its hero, is a radiant, snaggle-toothed young photographer, played by Melanie Mayron. Her best friend, Anne, Anita Skinner, longs to be a writer. Each woman wants to be an artist. Each is convinced the other's life is more real. Doused in mundane epiphanies, a godmother to girls, Lady Bird, Even I May Destroy You, it felt like the kind of movie I'd been waiting for all my life. Wheel, who got her start making short films like Metropole, a documentary about go-go dancers, was instinctively drawn to the issue of what later would be called the male gaze. "I was very preoccupied with women looking at men, looking at women," Wheel says now, "or how people perceive women versus how we really are." Girlfriends was the culmination of a decade in the industry, yet the film slipped through the canonical cracks. Criterion Classics finally released a Blu-ray edition of Girlfriends at the end of 2020, 42 years after its initial run. 2 years after Girlfriends, Wheel made another feature, It's My Turn. A romantic comedy about a similarly independent woman played by Jill Clayburgh, it was produced by Ray Stark, the towering Hollywood figure behind hits like Funny Lady and The Way We Were. This time, Wheel found herself demeaned and embattled. Ray Stark was a real bully, and so it was a difficult situation, she says now. Stark would walk up to her on the soundstage in front of her crew and ask if she was wearing a bra, running his hands up her back for confirmation. He certainly knew how to totally undermine my authority. Every creative choice felt scrutinized. If you shot more than 3 takes as a woman, it was like, oh my gosh, she doesn't know what she's doing. But if Michael Cimino did 190 takes, he was a genius. There was just a very different way of looking at women and looking at men. Wheel discovered while editing the movie that Stark had hired a shadow editor working just around the corner to secretly cut a version different from Wheel's. It was completely shocking, she says, especially for a New York filmmaker learning to navigate the shoals and make art at the same time. Stark died in 2004. She felt bruised by her experiences, and none of her feature projects afterward came to fruition. But when I was reporting this story, she asked me not to portray her as a victim of Hollywood. "I don't want it to seem like poor Claudia Wheel. That's not how I think of myself." Not now, after a long, successful career directing theater and television. Once she decided to have kids, the prospect of a manageable gig won out. "To get a movie made back then," Wheel says, "you have to just want this more than anything and be willing to do anything. I think there was part of me that just didn't want to go back into that cesspool." Next photos, Looking Glass, A still from Julie Dash's 1991 feature, Daughters of the Dust. Dash and screenwriter Ahmed El-Mouni on the set of the 1982 short film Illusions. A still from the 1979 film Old Boyfriends. Joan Tewksbury directs on the set of Old Boyfriends. The studio system was undergoing immense turmoil during the 1970s as a young, hip generation of cinema-obsessed male auteurs like Martin Scorsese, Francis Ford Coppola, Robert Altman, and George Lucas forged a new counter-mythology of Hollywood as a playpen for artistic mojo and risk-taking. Paul Schrader once said that in the early 70s, the door was wide open, and you could just waltz in and have these meetings and propose whatever, as long as you were a man. Barely 1 in 200 movies rated by the Motion Picture Association between 1970 and 1978 was made by a woman, as Maya Montañez-Smukler noted in the book Liberating Hollywood. This was no accidental oversight, as independent filmmaker Joan Micklin Silver discovered at one meeting. Feature films are expensive to make and expensive to market, and women directors are one more problem we don't need, the executive informed her. In a 1978 story in the New York Times headlined Women Film Makers, Women Film Directors, Will They, Too, Be Allowed to Bomb? Universal Studios executive Verna Fields worried that if a woman director had trouble on the set, guys might think she didn't shoot well that day because she had her period. Their films, like Joan Darling's First Love, were too often fatally meddled with during production, then misunderstood by critics upon release. It was nearly impossible for women to muster the financial or artistic support necessary to sustain a career. Many vanished from movie history after just one or two films, their work along with them. It's been only in recent years, in part thanks to new social movements and streaming dominance, that some of these neglected cinematic landmarks are being revisited. There were so many things against women making stuff, says contemporary director Joey Soloway, who is currently remaking Red Sonja. Whether it was their own belief in themselves to be able to think their story matters, the ability to get somebody to believe it, or the respect on the set. Orgasms, housework, motherhood, friendship. In the 1970s, these were no longer considered trivial female problems. The idea that women's history ought to be studied and understood, that was new too. Women's movies reflected these shifts. Barbara Loden played an Appalachian anti-hero who abandons her kids for a life of petty crime in her first and only film, 1970's Wanda. Joan Micklin Silver, who died last year, invented an idiosyncratic 19th-century Jewish feminist for her 1975 black-and-white gem, Hester Street. And Martha Coolidge began her film career in 1976 with Not a Pretty Picture, a hybrid fiction documentary circling her own date rape. Although Not a Pretty Picture attracted lots of attention, it took Coolidge 7 more years to get a feature film into theaters. The low-budget teen flick Valley Girl, which she turned into a sensation. Even then, studio execs didn't treat me like a guy, Coolidge says. They just showed me teen movies with people throwing up and girls with no names. As the second wave of feminism swept the country, American women directors mostly found themselves exiled to experimental film and the documentary milieu, where funding was smaller stakes and box office demands relatively nil. Docs offered a path for filmmakers like Julie Dash, Joyce Chopra, and Penelope Spheeris, though it would take many of them a decade or more to get a narrative feature made. That was the female ghetto, filmmaker Victoria Huckberg says, with a chuckle, noting that it could still take women years to raise the money for each project. Next photos, direct objects. A still from Joyce Chopra's 1985 film, Smooth Talk. Actor Laura Dern and Chopra behind the scenes of Smooth Talk. In 1971, documentarian Chopra recruited Wheel to handle the camera work on Joyce at 34, a groundbreaking short about the birth of Chopra's first child. Chopra had started out in 1960s Manhattan, hoping to make dramatic movies, but after months of knocking on producers' doors and being told she should be a secretary, she finally got a job working for documentarians Richard Laycock and D.A. Pennebaker. "There were three or four of us young pretty girls," Chopra recalls. "The young women all worked as assistants. They never pinched us, but the joke was always they hired us to see our cute little asses hanging over the print barrel." When Chopra was 8 months pregnant, a sociologist friend suggested she make a movie about herself. That was unheard of. Documentarians were supposed to train the camera on either important people or those languishing at the margins of society. Why would anyone make or watch a documentary about a white middle-class woman having a baby? Chopra nevertheless embarked on Joyce at 34, funded with $10,000 from New York PBS station WNET, with Wheel as her co-director. Within the first 5 minutes, the camera captures Chopra pushing a baby out of her body, dripping with blood and mucus, likely the first live birth shown on American television. The response from audiences was not always open-minded. Chopra heard a pissed-off guy outside one Massachusetts screening complain, "I thought I was going to see a film about James Joyce, and instead it's some ugly dame." Joyce, at 34, probed the trade-offs working women faced in the early 70s and included a cameo by Wheel's consciousness-raising group in New York, mulling their complicated lives. Actor Stockard Channing and poet Honor Moore were members. Ambitious women had been accustomed to thinking of themselves as exceptions who'd succeeded by being better than other women. Wheel says the group helped overcome the suspicion of each other that is built in by the culture so that women compete as opposed to being allies. When Chopra couldn't find a distributor for Joyce at 34, she and Wheel joined fledgling feminist distribution collective New Day Films, one of several that sprang up at the start of the decade, to create alternative pipelines for women's work. Chopra would go on to make Smooth Talk, 1985, and The Lemon Sisters, 1990, before moving into TV work. While working on the documentary The Other Half of the Sky with Shirley MacLaine, Wheel developed a project about growing up Jewish and female. By the time the grant money came through, she decided to make a fictional version instead, stringing together cash from grants and private funding. That was Girlfriends. After the film was accepted at the Cannes Film Festival Director's Fortnight, Wheel flew to Hollywood and started cold-calling studios using the Yellow Pages. There was only one print, which Wheel shuttled from studio to studio in a rental car, occasionally running out of gas. She had no lawyer or agent. Execs seemed bemused, but within a few weeks, she'd managed to pull in distribution bids from three studios. Girlfriends landed at a moment when Hollywood had begun to grasp that the newly liberated woman might like to watch movies centered on female perspectives. Successes with female leads in films like An Unmarried Woman and Looking for Mr. Goodbar indicated a market for The Reaping. All of them had been directed by men. But then Wheel turned up, a liberated woman in her 30s who was capable and marketable. I was the new thing, though I'd been making films for 10 or 12 years by then, and I think they were very excited to have one for their studio, like, oh good, even if it doesn't make that much money, this is interesting. If anyone should have been able to cut her own path through the swamp, it was Joan Tewksbury, a former child performer who'd spent years working on musical sets during their heyday. She dreamed of taking control of the Dream Factory machinery. I also realized it would never happen, Tewksbury says now. It was definitely a man's world. She drifted into directing Los Angeles Street Theater during the late 1960s. Robert Altman attended a production, and she worked up the nerve to ask if she could shadow him on set. Instead, he offered her a job on McCabe and Mrs. Miller. The script girl, who documents day-to-day changes on the set, needed replacing in a hurry because Altman had decided to cast her as one of Mrs. Miller's prostitutes. In the midst of a divorce, Tewksbury packed suitcases for herself and her two small children and zipped off to Canada to become the script supervisor. When the film wrapped, Tewksbury asked Altman if she should go to film school. He suggested that she write a movie herself. The result was her first screenplay, a dark comedy called After Ever After, about the collapse of her marriage. Although Altman signed on to produce it, they couldn't get financing, even after she wrote the screenplays for two of his next films, Thieves Like Us and Nashville. Considered one of Altman's career-defining masterpieces, Nashville was nominated for 5 Oscars in 1976, including Best Picture and Best Director. Meanwhile, male Altman protege Alan Rudolph launched into a thriving career with movies like Choose Me and Trouble in Mind. Nobody thought of it as discrimination at the time. They just didn't think women could do the work, the late producer Polly Platt once quipped. It was she who introduced Tewksbury to Jeff Berg, an agent who in turn convinced another client, Ascendant Taxi Driver screenwriter Paul Schrader, to put Tewksbury in the director's chair for Old Girlfriends, an edgy revenge screenplay he'd written with his brother. In Tewksbury's hands, Schrader's Old Girlfriends became Old Boyfriends, a poetic, unstable tale of a recently traumatized psychologist, Talia Shire, who sets out on a cross-country trip to reconnect with old flames. Tewksbury rewrote the script so that basically Talia would have something to play with the internal life of a woman. She added details that resonated, like a storyline about sexual humiliation at the panty-stealing hands of a high school boyfriend played by John Belushi. The men around Tewksbury didn't particularly understand or approve of her choices. A happy ending was tacked on, and the editor scrapped the intended opening shot of her hero cutting out images of women she admired from magazines. He'd insisted audiences would think the character was a lesbian. The final product was greeted with critical puzzlement. New York Magazine's David Denby compared it to a workshop production. Now I want to see a real movie from Tewksbury. But try as she might, she couldn't get a real movie greenlighted. Old Boyfriends had been so thoroughly forgotten that when UCLA's Film and Television Archive wanted to hold a public screening of the movie a few years ago, they discovered the only version available was in horrible disrepair. An archive director, Maya Montagnez-Smukler, says, "We all could see just the impact of prejudice on our film history in looking at this print." The original producers restored the film, now available on Blu-ray and streaming on Criterion Channel and Canopy. But at the time, with children to feed, Tewksbury turned to television, then a medium with a lowlier status. There she built a career doing movies of the week and episodics. "I could direct something that I had written every year," she says, "so I figured, why fight it?" While it was hard for white women directors to blaze a trail, it was nearly impossible for black women. In 1971, writer and civil rights activist Maya Angelou began adapting her memoir, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, for a movie she planned to direct. The book had made her internationally famous, but after 8 years of struggling to get it onto the big screen, it ended up as a CBS TV movie directed by a TV veteran, a white man. Ha! Hollywood never before trusted a budget of $1.5 million to a black woman, Angelo told the Los Angeles Times in 1978, even one with enormous cultural capital. Though she was one of the first black women inducted into the director's category of the Directors Guild, Angelo wasn't able to direct a long-form feature until Down in the Delta. That was in 1998, when she was 70 years old. And then there was Daughters of the Dust. Julie Dash initially started making movies as a teenager in late 1960s New York. Her response to the revolutionary ferment of the times was taking her 16-millimeter camera into rallies and protest. She moved cross-country in the early 70s, getting graduate degrees at the American Film Institute and then at UCLA's film school. Her evocative 1975 short film, Four Women, a choreographed unraveling of black female archetypes set to a Nina Simone ballad, won a prize at the Miami International Film Festival. And she bonded with a multiracial creative circle, later dubbed the L.A. Rebellion, collaborating and comparing notes with black women film students like Barbara McCulloch and Eileel Sharon Larkin. Our films were different, the women filmmakers, Dash says. We had our own agenda and issues in which to explore and wander and then reimagine womanhood, and they were usually very different from what the guys were doing at the time. As a grad student, Dash had dreamed up and shot a quartet of films about black American women's lives across a century. One, Illusions, was a noir picture about a black female movie studio employee passing for white in 1940s Hollywood. The film snagged Dash lunch dates with executives at several big studios. They wanted to know, how'd I make such a low-budget film look like it cost more? Dash recalls, smiling, but no, there was nothing for me there. She'd also written the screenplay for Daughters of the Dust. Set at the turn of the 20th century, Daughters dove deep into the lives of the Gullah women on Georgia's sea islands. Dash spent many years laying down a bedrock of dazzling visual and emotional detail. With an $800,000 boost from PBS's American Playhouse and a Sundance premiere, along with Richard Linklater's Slacker and Todd Haynes' Poison, it finally made it to movie screens and became the first feature movie by an African-American woman to be distributed theatrically in the United States. The year? 1992. On the heels of that success, Dash made the rounds of every major and independent studio with scripts and story ideas in hand. Not one bit. They wanted what they were accustomed to seeing from black directors, she says, slave movies or an urban testosterone film, and there was no in-between. Dash turned to directing on the small screen, but her earlier work is being rediscovered, too. Daughters of the Dust was digitally restored and re-released in 2016 when Beyoncé released Lemonade, counting Dash's movie as inspiration. Dash's short films appeared on the Criterion Channel in December, several months after the New York Times pointed out the dearth of black directors in Criterion's pantheon. She is currently working on a biopic about Angela Davis, and the scripts in her back pocket include an encryption thriller, a drama about black traveling magicians, and a limited series about a battalion of African-American women who served overseas during World War II. She's been pitching that last one for 11 years. Some people say, well, you really came a little too early, Dash says, shrugging. I was born exactly when I was supposed to be. The problem was the gatekeepers, who wanted to see their known world recreated, you know, and that's not what I wanted to produce. I had other stories I wanted to tell, and I still do. Thank you. Now here's a Vanity Fair spotlight by Johanna Desta. Swan Song. With photo of Chadwick Boseman, blow that horn, on the set of Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Chadwick Boseman's turn in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom gives us a sublime final glimpse of a beloved artist. When Chadwick Boseman was a student at Howard University, he was known for carrying two key things in his satchel, a Bible and an August Wilson play. How fitting, then, that 2 decades after graduation, he made his final on-screen bow in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, an adaptation of Wilson's charged 1982 masterpiece. To see him reconnect with that text felt very full circle, says Logan Coles, Boseman's close friend and business partner. Boseman, who died in August of colon cancer at the age of 43, is a force, says Levy, a charismatic cornet player trying to dodge his perilously bad luck and make a new path for himself. In one scene, he expertly seduces a woman he just met. In another, he tearfully shouts at God, daring to be struck down, a final blow in a life full of suffering. Chadwick played a character that is probably the greatest role written for a young black actor ever in history, says Viola Davis, who plays Ma Rainey. Levy, she says, represents every black man at that time, and at this time, driven by trauma that he doesn't know what to do with, and dreams and talent that he doesn't know how to harness. There was no one better to play the part than Boseman, an actor whose herb is a meticulous, devoted study in black history and exaltation. He's capable of taking these iconic, mythic figures and making them human, says director George C. Wolfe. There are these incredible qualities that he has, the mythic potency of a star, and the depth and the range and the command of an effing brilliant, brilliant, glorious actor. That's a startling thing. During filming, Boseman carried something different than he did in his college days, a djembe drum, which he played in his trailer and which seemed to feed him in some elemental way. I'm getting goosebumps now, says Davis, thinking back to the spirit it evoked. It's hard for me to think of his life tragically, because he made the most of his time. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.